Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we have reports from Ana Mateo and Anne Ball. We close the show with our American History Program, The Making of a Nation. But first, Purdue Pharma, maker of the drug OxyContin, has sought bankruptcy protection in an American court. Purdue's board of directors met Sunday night to approve the expected bankruptcy request. The company is hoping to restructure itself in an effort to settle all the legal claims against it. Local and state governments, as well as private individuals, have brought legal action against Purdue Pharma. They claim it aggressively marketed dangerous painkillers that helped fuel the opioid crisis in the United States. Government studies have shown that nearly 400,000 people died from opioid use between 1999 and 2017. Purdue's lawyers reached a conditional deal to settle cases with 24 states, 5 U.S. territories, and other plaintiffs. They include more than 2,000 cities and county governments. 24 states are either against the deal or unsure about the possible settlement. This may lead to an ugly legal battle over who is to blame for the opioid crisis. Thousands of cities and nearly every state have taken legal action against Purdue and, in some cases, the Sackler family, which has a controlling interest in the company. The cases claim the company and family lied to doctors and patients about the effects of the painkiller. Millions of people became dependent on opioids, and many suffered or died from misuse of the drug. Purdue and the Sacklers have denied the charges. Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York are three states that oppose the conditional deal. They want the Sacklers to guarantee more of their own money to pay for a settlement. They also have questioned Purdue's estimate that $10 billion is enough money to pay all the victims. The Sacklers would give up control of Purdue if the settlement is completed, the company says. It also says the family has offered $3 billion in payments and an additional $1.5 million or more through the sale of another company called Mundy Pharma. The Sacklers have also said they will not change their offer in any way. There are only two ways to go from here, said Purdue chairman Steve Miller. He said Purdue plans to argue to opposing states that fighting the possible settlement will likely result in additional and more costly cases. Those will reduce the value of the company and, in the end, leave less money for the victims. Miller spoke to the Reuters news agency. In a statement, Sackler family members said, they hoped those against the offer will change their minds. A U.S. bankruptcy judge would have to consider a reorganization and settlement. States and others are claiming the Sacklers earned billions of dollars from opioid sales while knowing they were dangerous and harmful. The Sacklers have denied the charges. States opposed to the settlement offer have said they will fight attempts by Purdue and the Sacklers to use bankruptcy to end all the legal actions against the company. On Friday, New York Attorney General Letitia James said she discovered that the Sacklers had moved about $1 billion to other companies and to banks in Switzerland. The information James found showed that Mortimer D.A. Sackler, a former board member, moved the money. Her office claims that he used false companies to move Purdue money around the world. She also said he hid money in at least two properties he bought in New York City. A spokesman for Mortimer D.A. Sackler said all his actions were perfectly legal. He also said that the money was moved more than 20 years ago. He said the accusations were an attempt to get publicity for the New York Attorney General's office.
A new large transport ship will help China get supplies to the islands it controls in the disputed South China Sea. China is one of six governments with territorial claims to the 3.5 million square kilometer waterway. Since 2010, the others have expressed concern about Chinese efforts to build up islets or small islands for military purposes. Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Philippines claim all or parts of the South China Sea. China claims about 90% of it. The waterway is rich in natural resources. The Sansha No. 2 transport ship can cover the whole South China Sea, reports China's state-operated Xinhua News Agency. The ship passed tests in August. It has a displacement of over 8,000 metric tons and will help civilian and military work, Xinhua said. The transport ship can go 6,000 kilometers without refueling and carry up to 400 people, the news agency noted. A ship that went into use 11 years ago could carry just 2,540 metric tons. The Sansha No. 2 ship will help take equipment to the Paracel Islands, an area controlled by China, but also claimed by Vietnam. Some observers predict the ship may also take supplies to the more widely contested Spratly Islands. Jay Batongbakal, a professor at the University of the Philippines, says China is showing other countries what it can do. They're expanding their capabilities in all areas, he said. Deploying in the disputed areas is even more symbolic. It's also more important for them because they're able to keep ahead of the rest of the area. This new large ship will probably take ammunition, food, fresh water, and power equipment to the islets it now controls, said Andrew Yang of the Chinese Council of Advanced Policy Studies in Taiwan. The South China Sea stretches from Hong Kong south to the island of Borneo. The six governments with territorial claims prize it for fisheries, energy reserves, and shipping lanes. On three major islets in the Spratlys, China has built runways and buildings to hold military airplanes, notes the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Other countries with South China Sea claims lack China's military power or technology. The People's Liberation Army, the world's third largest, flew bomber airplanes to the Spratly Islands last year. China plans to deploy floating nuclear power stations to the sea in 2020, says the U.S. Department of Defense. The transport ship marks the latest technology for China, Batong Bakal said. The United States began increasing the number of ship passages through the sea in 2017 under President Donald Trump. The U.S. government does not claim the waterway, but believes it should be open for international use. I'm Ann Ball.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Cancer is now the leading cause of death in wealthy countries. Researchers say cancer has replaced heart disease as the top killer in the industrial world. If the trend continues, they predict cancer could become the leading cause of death worldwide later in this century. However, the news is not that cancer deaths are increasing, but that deaths from cardiovascular disease are decreasing. Cardiovascular disease, or CVD, is a group of medical conditions that include heart failure, heart attack, and stroke. It remains the leading cause of death among middle-aged adults worldwide. But when you only look at deaths in industrial economies, that is not the case. In those countries, the new report shows that cancer now kills 2 times as many people as cardiovascular disease. The findings were published in The Lancet and presented at the recent European Society of Cardiology Congress in Paris. The research comes from a large ongoing study called the Prospective Urban-Rural Epidemiology, or PURE. It is a project of the Population Health Research Institute of McMaster University and Hamilton Health Sciences in Canada. The PURE researchers have been collecting information about people from over 20 high, middle, and low-income countries. The data includes a person's medical history and individual behavior, such as physical activity and diet. Salim Yusuf is a researcher on the PURE study and a professor of medicine at McMaster University. He also serves as head of the Population Health Research Institute. Yusuf explained the study's findings in a statement to the press. The fact that cancer deaths are now twice as frequent as CVD deaths in high-income countries, Yusuf said, shows a change in the main cause of death in middle-aged people. He added that as CVD declines in many countries because of prevention and treatment, cancer mortality will likely become the leading cause of death globally in the future. Data from the PURE study has been used in several reports over the years. For this most recent report, the researchers followed more than 162,500 adults for 9.5 years. All of these men and women were between 35 and 70 years old. The subjects came from 21 countries. Gilles Dajanet helped to prepare the report. He is a professor at Laval University in Quebec, Canada. Speaking on a Canadian radio show, Dajanet explained that the world is experiencing a transition in disease trends. The main reason, he added, is the fact that cardiovascular disease rates have gone down in high-income countries. Dajanet noted that there is no increase in cancer rates. If anything, he said, there is a decrease. However, over the past 20 years, there has been a sharp decrease in cardiovascular disease. He said the two main reasons are developments in medicine and technology and changes in personal behavior. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They planned to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, they wrote a completely new constitution. It created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we talked about the debate at the convention over the Virginia Plan. The plan was prepared by James Madison and other delegates from the state of Virginia. It described a national government with a supreme legislature, executive, and judiciary. Some delegates feared that such a central government would take away power from the states. But in the end, they approved the proposal. On June 1st, they began debate on the issue of a national executive. It seemed every delegate at the Philadelphia Convention had something to say about the issue. They had been thinking about it for some time. Almost every delegate was afraid to give the position extended powers. Almost no one wanted America's chief executive to become as powerful as a king. Still, many of the delegates had faith in the idea of a one-person executive. Others demanded an executive of three people. James Wilson of Pennsylvania argued for a single executive. He said the position required energy and the ability to make decisions quickly. He said these would best be found in one person. Edmund Randolph of Virginia disagreed strongly. He said he considered a one-person executive as the fetus of monarchy. John Dickinson of Delaware said he did not denounce the idea of having a government headed by a king. He said a monarchy was one of the best forms of government in the world. However, in America, he said, a king was out of the question. The debate over the size of the executive leadership lasted a long time. Finally, the delegates voted for a one-person executive. The question of how to limit power was a major part of the delegates' conversation, according to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
We're still talking about what are the limits of the national government? What is the role of the national government? How do we protect individual rights and individual liberties, etc.?
And he says that question continues to be asked in America today. During the debate at the convention, other questions about the national executive arose. One question was the executive's term. Should the executive serve just once, or could that person be re-elected? Alexander Hamilton argued for a long term of office. He said, if a president served only a year or two, America soon would have many former presidents. These former presidents, he said, would fight for power, and that would be bad for the peace of the nation. Benjamin Franklin argued for the right of re-election. The people, he said, were the rulers of a republic, and presidents were the servants of the people. If the people wanted to elect the same president again and again, they had the right to do this. In the final document, the president's term was set at 4 years, with re-election permitted. Next came the question of how to choose the president. It was a most difficult problem. The delegates debated and voted, and then re-debated and re-voted on a number of proposals. James Wilson proposed that the executive be elected by special representatives of the people called electors. Several delegates disagreed. They said the plan would be too difficult to carry out and would cost too much money. One delegate proposed that the president be elected by the state governors. He said, the governors of large states would have more votes than the governors of small states. Nobody liked this proposal, especially delegates from the small states. Another proposal was to have the president elected directly by the people. Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts was shocked by this idea. The people do not understand these things, he said. A few dishonest men can easily fool the people. The worst way to choose a president, he said, would be to have him elected by the people. The convention voted on the issue 60 times. In the end, the delegates agreed that the president should be chosen by electors named by state legislatures. Now someone said, we have decided how to choose the president, but what are we to do if he does bad things after being chosen? We should have some way of dismissing that person. Yes, the delegates agreed, it should be possible to try the president, and if he is found guilty, remove him from office. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania spoke in support of the right of impeachment should the president be persuaded to betray his trust. The delegates approved a proposal for removing a president found guilty of bribery, treason, or other high crimes. The last major question about executive authority was the question of veto power over the national legislature. Not one delegate was willing to give the president complete power to reject new laws, and yet they felt he should have some voice in the lawmaking process. If this were not done, they said, the office of president would have little meaning, and the national legislature would have the power of a dictator. James Madison offered a solution. The president should have the power to veto a law, Madison said, but his veto could be overturned if most of the members of the legislature voted to pass the law again. The final convention document listed more details about the office. For example, it said the president had to be a natural-born citizen of the United States or a citizen at the time the Constitution was adopted. The president must have lived in the United States for at least 14 years and be at least 35 years old. The executive would be paid, but the pay could not be increased or reduced during the term in office. The president would be commander-in-chief of the armed forces and, from time to time, report to the legislature on the State of the Union. The final document also gave the words by which a president would be sworn in. Every 4 years, for more than 200 years now, each president has repeated this oath of office. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Another major issue debated by the convention was a national judiciary, a federal system of courts and judges. The delegates knew a lot about the issue. 34 of them were lawyers. 8 were judges in their home states. One question hung heavy in the air. The states had their own courts and judges. Did the national government need its own system too? Several delegates said no. Roger Sherman of Connecticut said existing state courts were enough. Besides, he said, a system of national courts would be too costly. John Rutledge of South Carolina opposed a national system of lower courts, but he argued for a Supreme Court. Eventually, the convention voted for both. There would be a Supreme Court and a system of lower courts. The next question concerned the appointment of national judges. Some delegates believed judges should be appointed by the legislature. Others believed they should be appointed by the president. James Wilson argued in support of having one person appoint judges. He said experience showed that large bodies could not make appointments fairly or openly. John Rutledge disagreed strongly. By no means, he said, should the president appoint judges. He said that method looked too much like monarchy. Benjamin Franklin then told a funny little story. In Scotland, he said, he understood that judges were appointed by lawyers. They always chose the very best lawyer to be a judge. Then they divided that person's cases among themselves. The delegates voted on the issue. They agreed that the legislature could decide how many judges would sit on the Supreme Court. The president would appoint the judges. The legislature could establish lower courts from time to time. The president would appoint those judges too. The issues involving the executive and the federal courts were serious questions that most delegates felt strongly about. But the most hotly debated issue of the convention was still to come.
That's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.